lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me your
best. You're listening to episode 675 of Unwelcome Guests. What We're Not Being Told. I'm Robin Upton. And as the title suggests, this is something of a sequel to last month's episode on the ubiquitous matrix of lies, looking now not at deliberately concocted, misleading information served up as war propaganda, but looking at what's happened to the real reasons for wars, which never seem to get mentioned on the commercially controlled media. So, picking up where we left off, on Syria, and the seven countries the US planned to invade, one of which, of course, was Libya, we heard in episode 550, might well have been about banking, just as much as about oil. Now that was Ellen Brown. 125 shows later, the more it changes, the more it stays the same. We're going to hear Ellen Brown on a possible BIS Syria connection. And this is from the Global Research News Hour from the 19th of September 2013.
Over the course of the last several months, we've heard a lot of motivations for a possible military strike against Syria, ranging from a drive for oil to humanitarian intervention. But rarely do we hear the perspective that this has something to do with Syria's public banking system. Ellen Brown is an attorney, and she's the president of the Public Banking Institute. She's also the author of 12 books, including Web of Debt and The Public Bank Solution, which is her latest. And she's going to tell us now about a recent article she wrote in earlier this month. Ellen Brown, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, so the name of your article is Wall Street's Secret Economic Endgame, Making the World Safe for Banksters, Syria in the Crosshairs. Now, could you maybe just guide us a little bit about your argument here, that this is related to Syria's public banking system?
What I was writing about there was that it was an article that Greg Palast wrote about Larry Summers and Tim Geithner having an exchange in the late 1990s, where Geithner was writing to Summers and said, mentioned the financial endgame of the World Trade Organization. And then he gave the private phone numbers of some big Wall Street banker CEOs. And so what the endgame was that they wanted to open the world up to derivatives. That the U.S. banks were, they relaxed the Glass-Steagall, or they got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act, the part of it that prevented investment banking and depository banking in the same bank, you know, commingling those assets. So that was lifted, but it had to be lifted globally in order for it to work, because if other countries still had the protections of Glass-Steagall and still had, were regulating their own banks, then the investors would flee to those other countries because their investments would be safer, and they wanted to open these other big banks up to their whole derivatives scheme, which they did, of course. And the way they did it was to persuade all the members of the World Trade Organization to sign this financial services agreement that did open up all their banks to this sort of financial products, whereas before the World Trade Organization was just basically about trading physical products, you know, their bananas for our whatever, our cars or something. but now it included financial products. So that worked.
So you mean things like derivatives?
Yeah, derivatives, repos. That worked, but not everybody's in the World Trade Organization. So there are a few holdouts, and these are also holdouts from the Bank for International Settlements. And that would include these seven countries that were mentioned by Wesley Clark in a Democracy Now! interview around the time of the Iraq War. And he said he had been told after 2001 by a general that we were going to war with that we would be going to war not just with Iraq, but with these seven countries. They're all Islamic and in the Middle East area. So it was Iraq, Iran, Libya, Syria, Lebanon, Sudan, and Somalia. And indeed, you know, that seems to be working out, and they've taken down Iraq, they've taken down Libya, and Iran has been pretty well circled. I mean, it's been boycotted heavily, and Syria is the current big target.
Mm. Now, countries, like since they've been taken down, like Iraq, for example, Libya, what has happened to the banking system since those encounters?
Well, Libya was particularly interesting. I wrote an article on that, too. Before they had, the rebels were just supposedly this bunch of ragtag rebels, and they set up their own central bank. This was in March of whatever year it was. Was it 2011? When they were just starting this war. So that's a pretty sophisticated thing for rebels to do. And so a number of commentators remarked on that, how odd that they were setting up their own bank. It seemed to be somebody bigger was prodding them on that. And the Libyan central bank at that time, Gaddafi was attempting to organize this entire Africa. It would be the equivalent of the World Trade Organization, but it would be, or the equivalent of the IMF, but it would be the African Monetary Fund, and they would fund projects such as what they had already done in Libya by issuing their own money through their own central bank, was to turn the desert green by bringing the water to the desert, and they were starting to do that elsewhere, and the funding was coming largely from Libya. And, of course, Gaddafi wanted to abandon the dollar and the euro and to sell oil to sell products generally in this gold-backed currency, the gold dinar. So he was attempting to set up that system in Africa so they'd be independent. And this obviously had to be stopped, and it was stopped. And Iraq, too, when they first, where they first seemed to get in trouble was when they broke away from selling their oil only in dollars, and they said they were going to sell it in euros as well, which originally everybody laughed because the euro wasn't strong, but then it came out to be stronger than the dollar, and this was also a threat. The dollar went off the gold standard under Nixon in 1971, the dollar suddenly dropped, and then there was a big meeting in Sweden of these big financiers what to do about it, and they decided they would back the dollar with oil. And this is under Kissinger. Henry Kissinger met with the Shah of Iran, and they agreed that that the OPEC countries would sell their oil only in dollars, and in return the price of oil was going to be jacked up by, it was quadrupled right after that due to that little 9 days war. And so all these countries that thought they had enough dollars to buy their oil, suddenly, because the price of oil had gone up by a factor of 400%, they no longer had sufficient money, and so they had to borrow from the Wall Street and London banks. And that put them all in debt to Wall Street and London. So that's the system we have now, where all these countries globally are in debt to our banks. But there were a few holdouts, and those were the ones that were targeted as rogue states.
Well, there's a saying that the debtor is slave to the lender, and this is a way, essentially, of maintaining control over these countries. Is that essentially what we're talking about?
Right. In fact, the whole Bank for International Settlements was set up. This is what my new book is, The Public Bank Solution. So I trace the whole evolution of the Bank for International Settlements. It started in 1912. The Commonwealth Bank of Australia set up their own central bank that just issued credit for the purposes of the nation, and they did remarkable things. They rebuilt the nation. They, you know, put in roadways and seaways and all sorts of infrastructure. And they financed their participation in World War One without having to borrow from England. And this quite alarmed the Bank of England. The head of the bank went to England and boasted that anything Australians could imagine they could have because they were using their own credit issued by their own bank. So the Bank of the City of London was quite alarmed, and that man passed away rather suddenly after that of a heart attack. And then they put in a new system where the central bank would issue the money and lend it to the government rather than the central bank actually being a government bank that just printed the money and issued it for government purposes. So they got so excited about this that they decided to have this system where all the countries, or all the Commonwealth countries, which were their former colonies but which they were controlling economically by putting them in debt, that all the former colonies would be set up in this way with a central bank that was supposedly government but would actually be independent, and it would issue the national currency and lend it to the government and lend it to the banks. So that's the system that got set up, and anybody that stepped outside of it would tended to get crushed. Mm-hmm. And that became the Bank for International Settlements when the City of London sort of lost. After World War One, the British didn't have the same financial power that they had before, so they needed the Americans, and they needed the Bank for International Settlements was really originally set up by four big bankers. It was the U.S., England, France, and Germany. And Germany was in there supposedly because they were the ones that had to pay the reparations to England and France. And they were supposed to pay everybody's damages from World War One, and they didn't have the money, so they had borrowed from the U.S. to pay under the Dawes plan, and there was another plan, I forget, and they paid off. So they were supposed to be paying off their war reparations, but in fact, that put Germany in a key position. It was what you were talking about, the debtor is mm-hmm. a servant to the lender. But if you have a really, I think that same saying goes something about, but if you have a really big debt, suddenly the debtor is in control, you know, because in other words, if you've lent somebody a lot of money, suddenly you want to make sure they do well so that you can get your money back. And so the American businesses were all, or the Wall Street businesses were catering to the Germans to make sure they got their money back.
Hmm. So I notice one other thing you point out in your article is in terms of Obama's motivation. You mentioned that Larry Summers, the person of Larry Summers, has a background with Barack Obama, correct?
Yeah, he was the Barack Obama's choice for the next Federal Reserve chairman, but he recently withdrew his name from the hat, apparently, because he didn't want to get raked over the coals in Congress. It was clear that he was going to take a lot of heat. But this is one of many things that has been brought up against him, was that he was totally instrumental in this opening up the derivatives, which then shot up to, it depends on who you look at, but somewhere between 700 trillion and 1.4 quadrillion, shot way up because it's a very lucrative business for the banks, and they've kind of forgotten about lending to local businesses because they're more interested in the derivatives now.
Mm. Now, I think that many of our listeners are familiar with, there's been a march across the 20th century where you'd have one country after another, like Iran in 53, Guatemala, Chile, that they're all in 73, that any efforts to nationalize certain industries are rewarded by some sort of an overthrow. Are there any other such state? I mean, you mentioned the state-owned banks in Syria and Iran, but are there other assets there that might act as some sort of a motivation for overthrow?
Well, I know there was in Syria. There's that supposedly there would be an oil line put through to allow the oil go directly to Russia. And I'm actually not an expert in the oil issues, but I know there are other reasons. But that I was just pointing out this one as something that nobody's really focused on, and it does tie all those countries together rather suspiciously.
And looking at the map, I think what Alan Brown meant as far as the pipeline is that since Syria borders with Iraq and has a Mediterranean coastline, then controlling Syria could allow for easy shipment of Iraqi oil, and Saudi oil for that matter, via Iraq, Syria, straight to tankers in the Mediterranean, avoiding the need to go round Africa through Suez or the Straits of Hormuz. Now, last time the name of the Bank of International Settlements came up, I asked, did anybody have any information on them, and drew a complete blank. So I thought I'd do a little bit of research myself. Now, I'm just going on Wikipedia, which, as I'm sure you're aware, I don't consider to be any type of impartial source. It's more or less the official narrative. Since it relies so heavily on what it terms reliable sources, and remember, if you're a blogger, you're not reliable, unless you're a professional blogger, in which case you might be reliable, in Wikipedia's opinion. So this is more or less another arm of the commercially controlled media. If it says it on TV and radio or in newspapers in print, that's reliable. If it says it in an accredited peer-reviewed academic journal, that's reliable. Well, we're going to hear in hour two why science isn't as clean and free of the influence of organized money and the powers that be as it would have you believe. So, what Wikipedia says about the Bank of International Settlements in the first paragraph is that it's not accountable to any single national government. Does that mean it's accountable to a group of national governments? Does that mean it's not accountable to national governments? My next stop was BIS.org, the website for the Bank of International Settlements, and I found my way to the agreement between the Swiss Federal Council and the BIS to determine the bank's legal status in Switzerland, Article 3 of which states, inviolability, the buildings or parts of buildings and surrounding land which, whoever may be the owner thereof, are used for the purposes of the bank, shall be inviolable. No agent of the Swiss public authorities may enter therein without the express consent of the bank. Now, I'm no lawyer, but when it states things like the bank shall exercise supervision of and police power over its premises, presumably policeman is an agent of the Swiss government and therefore prohibited from the BIS unless they're invited in. And the next article, the bank shall enjoy immunity from jurisdiction, save A, to the extent that such immunity is formally waived in individual cases by the president, the general manager of the bank, or their duly authorized representatives, B, in civil or commercial suits arising from banking or financial transactions. Does that talking about criminal convictions? Not sure. Initiated by contractual counterparties of the bank, except in those cases in which provision for arbitration has been or shall have been made, or in the case of any civil action against the bank for damage caused by any vehicle belonging to or operated on behalf of the bank. So, what about criminal cases against the bank? There doesn't appear to be a mention here. So, Does that mean the bank is immune from criminal prosecution? Well, I've just searched the document for references to criminal offences, and there's only one. In the section pertaining to privileges and immunities, Article 12 states, quote, "The members of the board of directors of the bank, together with the representatives of those central banks which are members of the bank, shall enjoy, while carrying out their duties in Switzerland, and throughout their journey to or from the place where a meeting is held, the following privileges and immunities, including immunity from arrest or imprisonment, and immunity from seizure of their personal baggage, save in flagrant cases of criminal offence." So, if they commit flagrant criminal offences, then they may be arrested or imprisoned, and their baggage may be seized. I don't know quite how that fits with the next section, which says inviolability of all papers and documents. But according to this agreement, they're not going to be found liable for any offences unless they're flagrantly criminal. What does flagrant mean? Well, conspicuous. If they get caught with their fingers in the till and the cameras are rolling, then yeah, that's flagrant, they'll be liable for that. If somebody clever looks at the archives, works out there's been some wrongdoing, well, because it's not flagrant, then there hasn't been any wrongdoing, they're not criminally liable. Now, back to Wikipedia. BIS was established in 1930, apparently to facilitate reparations imposed on Germany, and the board of directors included a chap who was in charge of the Nazi gold, and another prominent Nazi official who was imprisoned for life at Nuremberg. Now, as a result of these characters, it was decided at Bretton Woods in 1944 that the BIS would be liquidated, but somehow this never happened, and after the war, British and American governments decided not to liquidate it. Doesn't say whether any Nazi gold was involved there. And it used to be owned both by governments and private individuals, but it's now owned wholly by BIS members, that is, central banks, who, in spite of a lot of smoke and mirrors, don't tend to be subordinate to government, certainly not in practice, and often not in theory either. So, who are these actual people who are running it? Well, Wikipedia provides us with a list of the 10 general managers from 1930 to the present day of the Bank of International Settlements, including Roger Aubin, who was general manager for 20 years. Now, you might have thought that somebody who was the general manager for the Bank of International Settlements for 20 years would be worthy of an English Wikipedia page, but apparently not. What about his predecessor, Pierre Quesnay? Not a chap I'd heard of, but he was general manager for 8 years. None of these people have got English Wikipedia pages. The first 6 general managers of the Bank for International Settlements, spanning 1930 to 1985, don't feature in English Wikipedia. So, how much information exists about these people online? A very brief way to look at that, just googling it and how many hits are there. Roger Aubin, the chap who was general manager for 20 years, has got 14,600 hits. Now, if that sounds like a lot, remember, this is including anybody else who happens to be called Roger Aubin. And 14,600 for the entire internet, not massive. Pierre Quesnay, general manager for 8 years, 6,000 results. Guillaume Guindy, 1958 to 63, 10,000. Gabriel Ferrat, 63 to 71, 3,800. René Lard, 71 to 81, 4,600. Günter Schleiminger, 81 to 85, 4,200. So there is some material there, but I'm starting to understand why nobody got back to me with any information about the BIS. By contrast, if we Google on Robin Upton, I don't think it's a particularly common name, we have 20,000 hits, so more than any of the first six chaps who were general managers of the Bank for International Settlements. Now, I don't want you to think I'm knocking the BIS for secretly running the world's governments and money supplies. They do have an archive, and according to their website, all the documents they have, over 30 years old, are available in the archive. That's except for a limited number of ones that they've deemed to be unsuitable for public viewing, and they do allow a researcher to come and check the archive out. Apparently there's a maximum of two researchers are permitted at any one time, and that's only if they're working together on a joint project. So the normal maximum is one researcher. So possibly that's just a very small part of the building, and it would get a bit crowded if they had more than one person in at a time. You will be allowed to take photocopies. There's going to be a limit of 10 photocopies per day. Possibly they don't want to wear the machine out. Not quite sure why they're limiting it to 10 photocopies per day. And you're allowed to take a camera, but they specify it has to be a photo camera, so they're possibly not fans of digital technology. If you live in Switzerland, then I'd encourage you to take a day out to Basel. Why not send them an email and apply for access? You'd have to state your research interest and give your name, address, telephone number, and email address, and the name, address, telephone number, and email address of two referees who can vouch for your suitability to use the archive. And if you're one referee short, I'd be happy, if you're an unwelcome guest listener, to vouch for your suitability to use the archive. Your project could be, say, trying to work out who they are, whose interests they're working in. Then again, maybe I wouldn't be the best referee. Perhaps somebody working in the history or economics department of a university might be a better bet. But quite seriously, if you're interested in looking into the archives of the BIS, then you could get in touch if you're short of referees. Similarly, if you are a possible referee, that is, if you're an academic or other person who could credibly vouch for someone's suitability to use the BIS archive, and you'd like to do so for another unwelcome guest listener who is enterprising enough to see what's available in this archive, then do get in touch. And if we find one person and two referees, who knows? We might be able to find out at least what's in those archives. Now, that's not to say I'm necessarily very hopeful. Well, their website does admit that they're excluding any documents that they feel like from the archive. So I suspect most of the juicy stuff, memos from this chap who was a major war criminal at Nuremberg and so on, is probably not going to be available for public scrutiny. But people do miss things. Documents do slip through. So, if you live near Basel and you're interested to try a bit of active research, then I'd be keen to hear from you. And if you'd like to contact me via encrypted email, you can do so. There's a PGP key on the Unwelcome Guests website, and as far as I know, that would mean your communication is not susceptible to snooping by the NSA. Now, the next piece we have for you is the soundtrack of a YouTube video entitled The Best Enemies Money Can Buy. This is, for the first time on this show, the late professor and historian Anthony Sutton.
The video you're about to see is a very, very important interview. I did it back in 1980, in June of 1980, with Anthony Sutton. And, of course, Anthony had been a scholar at the Hoover Institute for really many, many years. And while he was there, he wrote the three volumes of Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development. He wrote his book, National Suicide. And these books went into the background of the funding of the Soviet Union from its inception, and of course his book, National Suicide, went into the fact that America was financing the Soviet Union all during the Vietnam War, while the Soviet Union was financing the North Vietnamese who were killing our boys in South Vietnam. In fact, everything was done to prevent Professor Sutton from either publishing the third volume of Western Technology or his book National Suicide. Tremendous pressure was brought to bear on his publisher so that National Suicide could not be brought out, so the American people were not to know that during the Vietnam War we were financing indirectly the North Vietnamese. Well, let me just show you a few of the books that Professor Sutton has written, and these would include, of course, The Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and FDR, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, and of course, National Suicide. He's probably written at least 10 other books, including The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, The Trilateralists Over Washington, Volumes 1 and 2. He's written extensively on the Skull and Bone Society, on gold, on diamonds. Certainly, Anthony Sutton is one of the finest writers that we have within the conservative movement today. And for the last 20 years, he hasn't been doing interviews. I've contacted him a number of times, asked him to do radio interviews with me, but he is unavailable. I think that you're going to find that this interview will explain to you who it was who financed Adolf Hitler and gave him the capability of waging war against the West, who it was who financed the Bolshevik movement after it was established in 1917 and kept it going until the Berlin Wall came down in 1989. You're going to learn about the Trilateral Commission. You're going to learn about who controls the media in the United States. Indeed, who is the invisible government and what the ultimate goal of that invisible government is, and why that invisible government financed Adolf Hitler and finances communism and has financed communism since its inception. And now to Anthony Sutton.
Dr. Sutton, you wrote three series of books while you were a research fellow at the Hoover Institute. Can you give me basically the background of the content of these series?
Yes, the series I wrote at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University concerned the transfers of Western technology to the Soviet Union, and essentially it comprised three individual books. Each book covers a period of time since 1917.
And then you wrote a second series of books on Wall Street.
Yes, these were trade books. In other words, they're not academic books. They're written for the general public. They concerned the build-up of the three types of socialism, Bolshevik socialism in Russia, what we might call welfare socialism in the United States, and Hitlerian or national socialism. And each book examines the financing and the contributions made by Wall Street, by international bankers, to the development of that specific form of socialism.
Now, in your research and analysis and your efforts to bring out the facts about what was going on in our society, did you encounter any effort to discourage you, to prevent you from bringing out the background of America's involvement in the financing of international communism?
Yes, very definitely. For example, when I was at the Hoover Institution, in 1972, I went to Miami Beach to give some testimony before the Republican National Committee. And although a congressman had hand-delivered to the wire services this testimony, which was later printed, the wire services refused to transmit it to the newspapers. Then when I got back to the Hoover Institution in California, I was called into the office of the director, and I was told in no uncertain terms not to make any more speeches like that, and that this information should not be made public.
This was the information that we were giving Had the Soviet Union the technology to develop its war potential?
Oh, yes. At that time, we were in Vietnam. And as you know, the Soviets were supplying the North Vietnamese.
This was 1972?
1972, yes. And, for example, I knew that the Gorky plant, which was built by the Ford Motor Company, the Gorky plant in Russia produces the GAZ series of vehicles. The GAZ vehicles had been seen on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. We were supplying equipment to the Gorky plant in the middle of the Vietnamese War, and these trucks were being used to carry ammunition supplies, which were killing Americans. Now, I thought this was morally wrong, and I said so in Miami Beach and at the Hoover Institution. And it was this type of information that was suppressed.
And so what eventually happened as far as your activities at the Hoover Institution were concerned?
Well, I didn't pay much heed to the warnings. I published a book called National Suicide in the following year, which summarized our assistance to the Soviets, our military assistance to the Soviets. And when that book came out, there was great pressure to stop the book. There was pressure on both the publishers and me personally. And I felt I couldn't take this, and a few years later, I just left the Hoover Institution. Since 1975, I've been an independent author without any ties whatsoever.
Let's go a little bit into the background of the financing of the German war machine that we fought in the period 1941 to 1945. Could we start, first of all, with the original financing of Hitler between 1922 and 1923, when he was first making his effort to come into prominence in Germany?
The original financing of Hitler, that's in the years 1922, came only partly from Germany. One of the most prominent Americans concerned with financing Hitler was Henry Ford. In fact, Henry Ford received a medal in 1938 for his assistance to the early Nazi Party. Then, of course, Hitler had his attempted push in 1923. He went to jail, and then we begin another era in the rise of Hitler.
Right, and of course, he eventually came to power in 1933 by the electoral process. What about the financing of Hitler's electoral activities in 1933?
This I can trace. I have traced it very exactly. I discovered amongst the Nuremberg records a series of bank transfer slips to the Delbruck-Schickler Bank in Berlin to an account which was under the control of Rudolf Hess. And this was the fund that was used to finance Hitler's access to power in March 1973. And amongst the corporations that transferred money to Hitler, I find not only R.G. Farben, which is quite widely known, but also German General Electric, AEG, which is under the control of General Electric in the United States, or was at that time, and companies like Osram and...
Now, what was the tie-in between Osram and General Electric?
The tie-in was a share tie-in. International General Electric in the United States had controlling interest in German General Electric, and also through share interlocks, a controlling interest in Osram in Germany.
So then we have Ford and we have General Electric helping to finance Adolf Hitler's mm-hmm. rise to power. Mm-hmm. Were any other large American corporations involved?
Very definitely. Standard Oil, through its technical association with IG Farben. For example, Germany could not have gone to war in 1939 without tetraethyl. You need tetraethyl to raise the octane value of aviation gasoline. Germany had no means of doing that. This was developed in the ethyl laboratories in the United States and transferred to the Germans. Standard Oil came up with the hydrogenation idea, which was very essential for Germany in the 1930s, because to raise the quality of its gasoline for aviation purposes. This was transferred to the Nazis. And ITT, for example, International Telephone and Telegraph, was very intimately associated with the Nazis through Dr. Schroeder, who was head of the ITT subsidiaries in Germany. And ITT controlled companies which made not only electrical instruments, but also the Focke-Wulf plant, which made airplanes, fighter airplanes.
So what you're suggesting then is that American corporations were helping to finance the German industry that was building up the war potential?
American corporations, only a few, not many, financed Hitler through their subsidiaries. They transferred technology. They transferred material assistance, for example, stocks of tetraethyl before the Germans could manufacture it under the joint manufacturing agreement with the United States. And also they financed this. For example, Standard Oil financed in 1933 the development of the gasoline industry in Germany, which was needed to fight World War II.
And that's a very interesting point. Could you go a little bit into the background of where Germany got its oil to fight the Second World War? Because certainly Germany doesn't have oil resources.
Germany does not have oil resources, that's true. It used in World War II synthetic oil, which it got from coal. And the basic technical processes for the development of oil from coal came from the United States, essentially from the Standard Oil Laboratories, which had this technical assistance agreement with IG Farben. And of course, IG Farben contributed something like 60% of the explosives needed by the German Wehrmacht, probably about 40-50% of the gasoline needed by the Wehrmacht and by the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe.
And was there a definite interlock between IG Farben and Standard Oil?
The interlock was at the technical level, the exchange of patents. It was through a financial technical assistance agreement. There were other interlocks with the United States through a subsidiary, IG Farben, in the United States. But with Standard Oil, the interlocks with the technical and financial level.
And is it a fact, it's been stated, that there were members of the board of directors of Standard Oil who were also on the board of directors of American IG Farben?
Yes, Walter Teagle is one name that comes to mind. And there were several directors.
Was there an interlock with Ford between IG Farben and American IG Farben and the Ford Motor Company?
Not that I can recall, not offhand.
So basically what we're seeing then is American industry helping to provide the technology, helping to provide the finance, helping to provide the material that is going to allow Hitler to create his war machine.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct.
Now, in your book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, you talked about the bombing patterns during the Second World War and the fact that it was amazing that there were certain factories that were not bombed, whereas the majority of the German factories were decimated, German-owned factories. There were certain factories that tied into this interlock we've already alluded to that, for some strange reason, seemed to escape the devastation of our saturation bombing.
In World War II, the German electrical industry was or should have been a prime target for Western bombing. But in practice, the German General Electric plants were not bombed. Of the 10 major plants, not one was bombed, and a half a dozen others had trifling damage, broken windows, that kind of thing. So what we have here is a very interesting case of an industry which should have been bombed in World War II, but was not bombed, and yet we have American ownership, which raises a certain amount of suspicion as to why it was not bombed.
But as far as the German-owned electrical companies, did they undergo a rather heavy bombing?
I took a look at that. The Siemens plant, for example, they were bombed. There's no question. But the industry was not targeted as a general target. So Siemens, for example, was not bombed as heavily as, say, tank plants or aviation plants, that kind of thing.
You mentioned the Ford plant in Cologne. Was this a prime military target?
The Ford plant in Cologne should have been a prime military target. For example, the British Air Force, the Royal Air Force, did bomb the Ford plant at Poissy in France. But the Ford plant in Cologne, which was by far the largest Ford plant in Germany, was not bombed in World War II.
But did our military planners intend to bomb it? In other words, was it on the aiming report?
Well, I did look at the aiming reports for the plants in Cologne. Ford was known about. They knew that it was producing equipment for the Wehrmacht. But it was not bombed. It was scheduled as a target, but it was not bombed.
So somewhere along the line, as far as the planning was concerned, the name of the Ford Motor Plant in Cologne was deleted, and yet the city of Cologne itself was totally decimated.
The city of Cologne was decimated, as of course many other cities in Germany were decimated. But somewhere along the line, something happened. I suspect it was in the aiming committees, and without question, orders were sent out not to bomb certain targets, even though these were prime military targets.
And That's rather reminiscent of some of the orders that went out during the Korean War, some of the orders that went out during the Vietnamese War to leave specific targets within the enemy's domain untouched by our strategic bombing.
I understand that was so, although I've not investigated it.
Now, in your book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, there was one very interesting section about a special fund that Heinrich Himmler had, and the funneling of money from German corporations into this fund, even up into the years 1943 and 1944, and many of these corporations had strong ties into the American corporations, into the American parent corporations. Could you tell us a little bit about the Kepler Fund?
The Kepler Fund was also known as the Konto S Fund. It was what we might call Heinrich Himmler's personal slush fund. He used it for his own personal projects. And what amazed me was both in 1933 and in 1944, the two years for which I examined the records, over half the funds came from American corporations. For example, in 1933, ITT, Standard Oil, General Electric, and possibly Osram were contributors. Even in 1944, in the middle of World War II, we find that ITT was funneling funds to Heinrich Himmler's fund through Schroeder, who was the chairman of the ITT subsidiaries in Germany. We also find that DEPAG, the Standard Oil subsidiary in Germany, was financing Heinrich Himmler, and this was in the middle of World War II.
Now, were these facts ever brought out at the Nuremberg hearings?
They were never brought out at the Nuremberg hearings, although the documents do exist within the files, within the records. They have not been published, as far as I know.
And you actually had access to these records?
Yes, there's some 400 tons of these records available. And many of them were at the Hoover Institution, or copies were at the Hoover Institution, and that's where I found the original documentation.
I think it's a tragic part of our history when the American public doesn't realize the interplay then between great American corporations and the financing, the funding of the Nazi movement. Now, I wanted to talk just a little bit about the Nuremberg trials, because at the Nuremberg trials, the Nazis, the Nazi war criminals, the Nazi generals were held specifically guilty for what transpired. Were there any Americans involved? Were any Americans indicted? Were any Americans convicted as far as the financing of the Nazi war movement?
Very definitely not. I looked at the criteria for what we might call war crimes under the Nuremberg tribunal. And there's no question in my mind that certain Americans well fitted the criteria which required indictment and trial. But no Americans were ever brought to trial.
Do you think there was any conscious effort to conceal this fact, both from the Nuremberg War Tribunal and from the American public?
Well, there was a conscious effort in the fact that these businessmen were very prominent in stating in 1946 that they had no knowledge of what Hitler was doing, and yet they were intimately involved with the build-up with Hitler. I suspect that this was not published in the media at the time, although I've not checked that. But certainly the role of American corporations and American businessmen in aiding Hitler has not been published.
Now, what about the actual financing? What about the loans from large American banks, from large British banks, to Hitler's government in that period between 1933 and 1939, when Hitler was preparing for war?
Well, you've got to go back a little earlier and look at what are known as the Young loans, which were very important because I think they brought about the economic collapse of Germany in 1933.
That was the Young plan.
This was Owen Young, who was, of course, chairman of General Electric. Here we got a man who actually made the loans as an officer of the United States government, which brought about the collapse of Germany in 1933, enabling Hitler to take over. And then subsequent to 1933, you get a series of loans. A very good one is Standard Oil, which loans several million dollars, at least, to Germany to build up its aviation gasoline facilities. And there are other examples.
Fine. Well, I'd like to get a little bit into the background of the financing of Bolshevism, because I think this is vitally important. And we can go back to the period after the Second Revolution, which was in October and November of 1917. The initial financing of Lenin's movement, how did it tie into the American corporations? Was there any American involvement in that period between 1917 and 1918 when Bolshevism was just beginning to get a foothold in Russia?
Yes, there were several incidents. The most important is one involving Colonel William Boyce Thompson, who was the largest shareholder in the Chase Bank, which of course today is Chase Manhattan Bank. And I published in one of my books a copy of a cablegram which transferred funds from New York to Petrograd in December 1917, $1 million to be precise. And Colonel Thompson made the statement later that this $1 million was given to the Bolsheviks to consolidate, that they had just begun to take over Russia. They only controlled Moscow and Petrograd at that time, to aid the control that the Bolsheviks were extending in Russia. This is a very clear case. $1 million, American funds, transferred through an American Wall Street intermediary to the Bolsheviks.
And didn't you publish that document here in Wall Street and the Rise of Bolshevism?
I published two statements. One is a copy of the cablegram, and the other is a copy of the news clip of the statement made by Colonel Thompson at that time that he had given, made this contribution.
Now, why would an American capitalist, an American financier, help to aid Bolshevism?
The only answer, and of course this puzzled me for years, you know, why? Because we understand there to be an opposition. And the only answer I can come to is one of captive markets. The United States did not want another United States in the world. And of course, if you look at the world map, Russia is two or three times larger than the United States. Imagine this as another United States, as another competitor to the United States. What the United States wanted, or Wall Street wanted, was a captive market. And of course, socialism is a captive market because my earlier studies at Stanford University had brought out the fact that a socialist system cannot innovate. It's got to import innovation and technology from the West. And so I think the aim behind this was to encourage the development of Marxism and other types of socialism, because this would give these Wall Street bankers control of a world market, a captive market.
At the end of the First World War, Russia was devastated by famine, and America sent a relief mission. It was the Hoover mission. Do you know any of the facts surrounding the activities of the Hoover Commission?
Well, there's no question that in 1922, 1923, Russia was finished. Industrial output was perhaps 8 or 10% of 1913 figures, and people were starving by the hundreds of thousands. And the Hoover mission was organized, of course, to send aid to Russia. But most of the aid went to the Bolsheviks, who controlled really quite a small part of Russia at that time. Only a very small part of the aid went to the White Russians or to the Far East.
And then after 1922-1923, Lenin instituted something known as the New Economic Policy, or this series of five-year plans. Can you tell us about the five-year plans and the part that the major American corporations, major world corporations, played in building up the Soviet Union?
Well, there are two separate phases here. The new economic policy was started in 1923 by Lenin, and I found, and I published this in my first book from Stanford, that every single Russian industry was rebuilt or restarted by foreign corporations, mostly German, British, French, and American. By 1928, Russia was back to approximately its 1913 industrial output. And at that point, she began to think of these grandiose five-year plans. And in 1928, Gosplan, which is the Russian Government Planning Commission, actually designed an initial five-year plan, but this was thrown out, it was inadequate, and American corporations were built in, were brought into Russia. And the first five-year plan and the second five-year plan were actually designed in the United States by American corporations.
And what were these corporations? Which ones specifically were involved?
The design of the first five-year plan was by a corporation probably not known to most Americans, Albert Kahn. But Albert Kahn was the foremost industrial architect in the United States. And Albert Kahn laid out the basics of the first five-year plan for the Soviets. And then we find, again, the same corporations involved with the construction of the plants, International General Electric, certainly, DuPont, Ford Motor, Hercules Motor, Curtis Wright in aircraft engines, and even some corporations which today were forgotten about, like Valti and Chance Vought. These were aircraft manufacturers at that time. And so American corporations came in and they built the first five-year plan. But what was important, the Soviets then copied these plans, and this accounts for the tremendous Russian output. They took this initial equipment and they multiplied it, they copied it by the hundred.
Now, how about Ford Motor Company? Did they play a part in the building up of the Soviet potential?
Very definitely. Ford Motor Company built the Gorky plant, and the Gorky plant produces the GAZ series of vehicles, that's GAZ, and these are trucks and some automobiles. And right from the early 1930s, you find that the GAZ plant has had military potential, and Ford knew that when it went in and built the Gorky plant. And we know it because I found statements to this effect within the State Department files.
Sometimes we hear the name Averell Harriman. Did he play a part in building up the Soviet technology?
Very definitely. In fact, Averell Harriman came out of the Soviet Union financially at a profit. He took over the Georgian manganese concession in the early 1920s, got this back on his feet for the Soviets, and manganese became a prime export for the Soviets, and so they were able to sell this abroad, get foreign exchange, which financed their industrialization. And then they bought out Harriman about 1929, and Averell Harriman received as compensation $1 million more than he put in the first place.
How about Armand Hammer of Occidental Petroleum?
Armand Hammer is a very interesting example. Armand Hammer received the first foreign concession in 1922. In asbestos in the Ural Mountains. And he also conducted for the Soviets a number of other enterprises, right down to pens and pencil manufacturing, for example. But Armand Hammer is interesting because his father, although Armand Hammer today is chairman of Occidental Petroleum Corporation, his father was Julius Hammer, who in 1919 was Secretary General of the Communist Party USA, which emphasizes the argument I made throughout my books, that at the top level, there's no difference between your top communist and your top capitalist, the interlink. You've got Armand Hammer, chairman of Occidental Petroleum. His father was secretary of the Communist Party USA in 1919.
So it's basically a power grab.
It's a power grab, an international power grab.
Now, during the Second World War, why Russia was pretty well decimated once again by German forces, what part did the American Lend-Lease program play in building up Russia's industrial capacity after the Second World War?
Well, Lend-Lease built up Russia's capacity, modernized it, and expanded it during World War II. And there was some continuation all the way through perhaps to 1948, 1949. There was a program after Lend-Lease, which was supposed to be restricted to foodstuffs and industrial materials. But in effect, I checked the records in the warehouses in Suitland, Maryland. I find that even after World War II, and this was against the intent of Congress, I suspect, there was a massive transfer of the latest industrial equipment to the Soviet Union under the so-called Lend-Lease program.
Now, in 1948, there was a fascinating book came out by Major Racy Jordan, in which he talked about American aid to the communists as far as their ability to build nuclear weapons. Did you ever have an opportunity of verifying the facts that we had given them the heavy water, we'd given them the wherewithal to build their atomic weapons?
Well, as part of the work I was doing at Stanford, I did investigate the shipping documents for Lend-Lease, and I took a sample of these documents and I checked them against Major Jordan. And broadly, Major Jordan was correct within, say, about 5%. And Major Jordan, of course, made the charge that we had shipped materials to the Soviets, 1944, 1945, which were later used in their atomic program. There is no doubt he is correct. We shipped heavy water, which is essential, but we shipped other items which are perhaps less obvious to the layman. We shipped, for example, aluminum tubes, and aluminum tubes are essential for atomic energy development. We shipped graphite, and graphite is another essential component. So generally, as far as I could check, and I checked the original government Lend-Lease document, General Major Jordan was correct.
Now, as the years have gone by, of course, we see a growing Soviet nuclear threat. The Soviets now have MIRV missiles. Mm-hmm. Can you get a little of the background on how the Soviet Union, which really didn't have the technology to develop those MIRV missiles that threaten our cities today, how were they able to develop the MIRV capacity?